That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show live on FUBAR Radio with me, That Money Guy, Your Money Guy. I like that name, actually, a little bit. Gabriel, we are here to do that one thing I promise you every single week, and that is to make you better with your money. I mean, that is my big mission, my big goal in life generally. So why not stick around with me for an hour or so to pretty much guarantee your knowledge with money improves. Anyway, what are we going to be doing this week to achieve that goal? Well, of course, I'm going to update you on what's going on in the world, in the economy, in the, you know, spectrum of the world that is personal finance. But we're not going to make it boring, guys. The stuff that you need to know that affects the money in your pocket is the stuff that we discuss on this show. So there will be no snooze fest here. You guys will absolutely devour the information that I will be sharing with you here today. It's interesting stuff. And of course, we bring in some interesting guests. We bring in some interesting experts, some famous people to share their own stories, understanding about money and general personal finance advice. And who do we have coming up this week? Well, we've got two very interesting guests. Firstly, Lee Gardner. You might know him as @LeePensionGuy. He is a financial planner and pension expert who's going to be discussing all things, you probably guessed it, pensions. Yeah, it might be a long way before you get to your pension, unless you are in your 50s listening to this. Well, let us know. You can always DM us on Instagram @ThatMoneyShow. But even if it is 20, 30, 40 years away, you probably want to start planning it now. That's my little bit of financial advice to you straight off the cuff. So that's going to be a great conversation for you to hear. And also, we are bringing in Ricardo Mighty, not just a cool name, but also a cool person. He is the CEO of Mighty Labs, a software developer turned crypto investor who's been actively investing in crypto for the last 8 years. And he's going to help us obviously understand the crazy world that is cryptocurrency. I don't understand it too well, so I've got a lot of questions to ask Ricardo. But shall we kick off with the news? I think that's a great place to start. And what better news, though? What more relevant news than what is Donald Trump up to since becoming president? And how is that going to affect your money? Well, the big news this week is Donald Trump's tariffs are beginning to come into play. This was his big election promise. Tariffs, tariffs, tariffs. We're going to charge people from outside of this country to send goods and services into this country. We're going to make the US economy the strongest economy internally, promoting US jobs, US products, US goods, US services, because that's what tariffs do. And we're going to punish our neighbors and countries around the world. Well, that was what he said. But is that actually true? And will these Donald Trump's tariffs actually hurt US consumers more than people from around the world? Well, let's tuck into the story, because what are the executive orders that he is signing off on? Well, currently, he is putting a 25% tariff, or, well, you can call it a tariff. It's a tax on imports, basically, on everything coming in from Canada and Mexico. Those are, for those of you that don't know, the two countries that literally have their land border with the United States. Canada, obviously, north. Mexico from the south. And the reason behind these tariffs is to get both of these countries to crack down on illegal immigration and drug trafficking. So he's basically said, there's not a lot, well, in order for you to be allowed to pass through all the legal stuff at a low cost, you need to stamp down on the illegal stuff. Good in like practice, but what actually is going to happen as a result of this? And number two, the other tariff that's coming in to play is on China. We know there's this big trade war between the US and China, and he is putting a 10% tariff above any additional tariffs until it cuts fentanyl smuggling. So this is another big problem in the US, a large amount of fentanyl that gets smuggled into the country from China. And again, he's punishing them with an additional 10% tariff on top of any other current tariffs. Remember, he's already pledged to target the country, that is China, with a 60% rate and has mulled a 200% tax on some car imports. Of course, China is the country of manufacturing. When it comes to car imports, the rise in electric cars that are coming from China. They have dozens of electric car brands that are flooding economies all around the world because they are so cheap for the Chinese to create and, you know, sell these cars. whereas other countries can't compete. And obviously, it's destroying the local markets. So let's go back. What is a tariff? What is actually going on here? And what will the effect of this be? So a tariff is quite literally this. If I am selling, you know, I don't know, I want to sell toothbrushes to America. Don't ask why I came up with toothbrushes. Maybe it's a sign that I need to go to the dentist. Anyway, I want to sell a toothbrush to America and it costs £100. It's a good toothbrush, by the way. I don't sell bad toothbrushes for £100. I'm a fair salesman. And I want to get it into the country. That tariff of 25% that he might put on me, I'm not saying that it is a 25% to the UK right now, this is just an example, hypothetical, means that in order for the importer, so let's say the company that wants to mass sell toothbrushes from all around the world to buy it from me, they now have to pay £100 to me to buy the product and 25% extra, so £25 goes straight to the US government. But it's crucial here to understand that the US importer is paying that tax. Not me selling the product, but the US importer, which starts to make things a little bit confusing, right? Because, you know, Trump has said that the whole idea behind these tariffs is to punish other countries and to make the US economy better, to make the individual consumer in the US wealthier, to make businesses wealthier. But isn't that a little bit confusing when I've just told you that the person that pays that tax, that pays that tariff, is actually the person buying the product? You might have experienced this here in the UK when you buy certain products from around the world. HMRC, whoever deals with the goods and imports and exports and all that kind of stuff, might send you a letter that says, we are currently holding your product until you have paid X amount in tariff for us to release that and deliver it to you. That is a tariff. That is how it works. You, the person buying the product, has to pay that tariff. So how does this work? And this is why a lot of people are universally agreeing that this is a misleading concept, that Trump is saying that this is not going to be a cost to Americans, it's going to cost another country. Now, there is a small element of truth to what he's saying, and I'm going to get into it. But let's understand the impact of tariffs altogether, okay? So Trump, let's say Trump imposes, like I said, this 50% tariff on whatever it is. I've just told you, the person that's paying the tariff is the person buying the product, the US person. And some of the data and the research is coming out that a typical household in the middle of the US income distribution is estimated will lose $1,700 per year because of these tariffs. This doesn't sound like a very protectionist policy, right? It sounds like you're actually making your own people spend money on products. And not just that, his second promise, one of the big Trump promises, is that tariffs will improve the quantity and quality of jobs in the US. Now, his promise, for example, is that, you know, we're going to stop importing as many goods from outside of the world. So we're going to need to start making more of these goods internally in the US. Therefore, places are going to need, you know, more employees, more people to create the stuff that we now need to fill the gaps. But a quick look back at 2018 in Trump's last period as president saw that he imposed 25% tariffs on imported steel to protect US producers. But just 2 years later, total employment in the US steel sector actually fell. It went from 84,000 down to 80,000. Again, you're starting to question, well, what's going on here? And a lot of the reason behind this is because of the rise in automation. So yes, companies inside the US will have the ability to fill a lot of voids, but they're not going to fill it with expensive labor. They're going to fill it with cheap automation, especially in the places that produce products. So you're kind of getting this little bit of confusion. What is really, really going on? And then you've got the third big issue. So US has always, or not always, but the US recently has had a lot of tariffs on China. There's these big trade wars that are going on. But one clever thing that China do to evade having to pay this tariff is that they've started to, you know, disperse the places that do the finishing touches on a lot of the things they sell around the world. They're starting to build factories in Cambodia and Thailand and other countries in Asia so that when they end up selling the product to the US, there's no tariffs on Thailand. There's no tariffs on Cambodia. There's no tariffs on other countries that are producing these products. And all of a sudden, China don't have to pay the tariff anymore. So you can see there are some things that are going on here. What is Trump trying to do, and what do economists agree that Trump might get out of this? So Here is the idea. So when I do sell these £100 toothbrushes to China, not to China, to America with this 25% tariff, there are kind of a few different scenarios that will play out. Number one is the person buying it will pass on all of these costs to you, the consumer. So now you have to pay, instead of £100 for the toothbrush, you have to pay £125. Therefore, the American citizen is suffering the most. Number two is the company that are buying the toothbrushes swallows these tariff costs. So it costs them now £125 to buy it, but they sell it at £100 again. Okay? In this scenario, obviously, they're making a loss, but it's basically the company, the companies that are importing a lot of these products and goods on mass amounts are the ones that are suffering. They are swallowing the tariff. And then the third and final example is that me, the British person trying to sell to America, has to decrease my price to make it attractive. So the US companies go, we're not buying this from you anymore. It's going to cost us £125. So now I drop my price so that all in with the tariff, it now costs £100 to send it to America. Therefore, I'm decreasing my price of sale and I am swallowing the tariff cost more or less from the product. So there's a lot of things going on at the moment. That's all going on with tariffs. Now, another brilliant story happened actually to me on Friday. I went to pay for parking from my Barclays current account. You know, one of those apps that you have to pay for parking. And I couldn't. It just wouldn't take my payment from Barclays. I switched over to my other bank account that I use and the payment went through fine. So that is exactly what happened on Friday. Barclays had a mass issue, a fallout of their technical services, basically a mass tech outage. You might have noticed. Are you a Barclays customer? Did you experience this yourself? They had a really, really big tech outage and apparently roughly 5,000 complaints were already registered. I know a number of people personally actually who were talking about the inability to send money. Now, this caused even more distress because on Friday, it was the self-assessment deadline, 31st of January, where people that need to file a self-assessment had to get this off to HMRC. And a lot of people were like, oh, crap, you know, like I can't actually send my money right now. It's not going through. People have been left in overdrafts. People have had missed payments. People don't know where their money is right now. Now, you have to be aware that Barclays will ultimately put this right. So spend as much time as you need. But if there is any mistake that's been made to your bank account, this is on Barclays, okay? So do not lose money on account of them. They will sort you out. And number two, a really important thing for you that were filing self-assessment returns is that you do not get fined if you miss. HMRC have said you will not be fined if, because of this outage, you weren't able to pay your self-assessment, because these only actually happen for those that miss out payments 3 months late. So you only get this £100 fine automatically if you are 3 months late on your payment. You do have to file your self-assessment before the deadline, but payment, you have 3 months to actually make that. So everyone take a deep breath. I'm hoping that most of these tech outages have been sorted by now, but do let us know if you were affected and how you were affected and if you've been able to sort that problem. Or on the other hand, if you haven't been able to sort that problem, we'd love to hear why not and what was the issue, because ultimately, this is on Barclays. This is their tech. They have said it wasn't a cybersecurity attack, but they haven't actually said what was the issue that was caused here. But of course, you know, we're living in this digital world and these are things that we're going to have to see more and more common at the moment. So yeah, let us know what's going on, but hopefully all will be resolved. Do not stress right now. Just call customer service and sort out that way. I think they had extension to their customer service hours anyway to sort these kind of problems out. I'm sure it was stressful at the time, but hopefully on this fine Monday, this grey Monday in London that I am right now, everything will be sorted. Anyway, guys, stick around, because after this short break, I'm going to be joined by Lee Gardner, at Lee the Pension Guy, a financial planner, pension expert, and he's going to be talking to me on all things pensions.
FUBAR Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my SAS sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either, because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald.
What would you be advising the Labour leadership to do at this point?
My view is just apologise. I went to the theatre last night. I'm with my wife and family, and as I'm walking, a bloke says very loudly, John McDonnell, has he paid for his tickets? I went back to the bloke, said, yeah, I did pay for my tickets, and I always do. What that whole ticketing thing and all the free gifts thing doesn't just damage those individuals, it damages us all, because they all think, oh, they're all the same, and we're not.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the truth. And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle. I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy. And as promised to you a second ago, I am joined now on the show by Lee Gardner, also known as Atlee, the pensions guy, a financial planner and pensions expert. Now, this is a topic you guys do not want to skip. I know it sounds like it might be a decade, two decades, three decades away, but by the end of this conversation, you'll know that it's not that far. It's actually starting today. Anyway, Lee, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good, Gabriel. I've been listening with interest. So, yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for asking.
Good. I'm glad to get you down here because one of my biggest gripes with the UK or just general lack of personal finance education is people don't understand pensions. They think it's so far away. Why bother putting money towards it, you know, in your 20s and 30s? Take that extra income, have a few extra pints after work on a Friday because of it, and happy days. I can think about the problems, you know, when I'm 50 and deal with it then. So, I mean, should we, you know, like address the elephant in the room? Why is that such a bad way to think about pensions?
Well, I've been providing pension advice for clients now for, I'd say, 35 years. And I think the challenges that I come up against are people that have done exactly what you've described, that they've not saved, they've had the extra pint down the pub, and they leave it to the last moment and suddenly realise that to try and bridge the gap, it's almost impossible. So, you know, most people are aware if you can start early, even with a small amount, it makes an enormous difference when you take into account, you know, compound interest and compound growth. And for me, the thing that's amazing with pensions, because I think I did tell you, I bloody love pensions, is there's nothing else that you can invest your money in where your employer will put money in and so will the taxman. So for me, that's a win-win.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many superpowers, I like to say, with a pension that make them not boring. You mentioned a few of them there, the tax benefits, the employer match benefits, the way that you can put in, you know, a small amount and end up with so much more. And this is before any compound interest or compound growth. We're talking just through the initial amount that you put in. But before we do get there, I kind of want to start with a bit of a pensions 101 for people out there that, you know, might never have learned this lesson and are paying or not paying a pension based off zero education. So should we go back to what are the various types of pensions and how do they work?
Yeah, no problem. So there's a state pension. So everyone, as long as you have a national insurance record, you will qualify for a state pension. And that's anybody that's working and paying national insurance. To get a full state pension, you need to have 35 years of qualifying national insurance contribution, and you will get the full state pension. It's index linked for the rest of your life, and you'll receive a payment every 4 weeks from the day you, from state pension age until the day you die.
Now, of course, the state pension age shifts and is getting older and older slowly and slowly. But people are also living longer and longer and working later and later. So it's kind of working in synergy with that. But you can't predict, for example, what's going to be happening in 34 or 40 years. But what are the current age thresholds for accessing pensions, state pensions or otherwise?
So, I mean, this is probably for younger people, this is probably something that isn't, doesn't feel like a great incentive and does feel a long way away. So if you were born after 1978, then you're not going to be entitled to state pension until age 68. So it's currently 67 for most people, but after 1978, it is going to shift. And it is one of those things, because it isn't a fund, the people that are being paid state pension now are being funded by the generation in work now. So it's one of those things that is an ever-moving target, depending on which government or who is in power and how they deem to change it. So it's currently for the younger people, it's likely to be 68, but just be prepared, it could be pushed on beyond that.
Got it. Shall we have a little talk about private pensions now, or pensions that you get through your workplace? So if you are employed, what are the kind of rules and regulations about pensions, and why are they such a incredible product that you don't want to be sleeping on?
I mean, for me, and as I said to you, I've been in the world of pensions for over 30 years, and for me, the biggest impact was the introduction of auto enrolment, and that is the legal obligation for all employers to enrol their members or their employees into a pension scheme. And what it basically means is if you're entitled, and there are a few rules around your age and income, which we won't get into now, but most people, once you get past 21 and you're earning a reasonable wage, you will be enrolled into a scheme automatically. But what happens is your contributions will be taken from your pay packet, you'll get tax relief from the government, and you will also get your employer contributing to the scheme. And as I say, it's free money in terms of the money that the government and your employer will basically put into a long-term savings plan that you can access in the future.
Exactly. Future, you'll be very happy with this. And there are some benefits. So you said it's auto-enrolled. So you are automatically opted into pensions these days. If you want to get out of it, you have to say no, thank you very much, rather than saying, correct, yes, please put me in. But now let's look at some of the tax benefits. So if I, let's say, you know, I'm looking at my payslip right now and I want to put in £100 a month into my pension, how much is actually ending up in my pension? Let's say if we are maximising the standard or the match scheme from companies, and how much of that is being contributed by me versus the government versus an employer?
Right, okay, if we rewind a little bit, so to the minimum rules that the government put in place were that for an auto-enrolment scheme, the employer has to pay in 3% of your income. So that's the amount that the employer has to pay as a minimum amount going into your pension, and the employee will pay 5% gross. So if it was a £100 contribution, the net cost to you would be £80. So for that £80 contribution going in, you're going to have the tax relief and the employer's contribution added to that of 3% of your salary. I mean, for me, it's a no-brainer.
It's like a 3% raise, isn't it?
It's crazy. And I think, yes, and the good news, by the way, when it comes to your private arrangements, you're not restricted like you are with state pension. So currently, you can access pension benefits from 55. Unfortunately, that age is going to move on. So again, thinking about the younger, younger members of the audience, potentially born that where their state pension age is 68, they can access private arrangements from 58. So you can access your own pension 10 years earlier than state pension age, which again is a great way to think about pensions, that you can stagger your retirement by taking, you know, money earlier, and then the state pension kicks in further down the line.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I need to stress that 3% bonus, that you're basically, if you say no to your pension, you are turning down a 3% bonus every single month. So if you're putting in, let's say, that £100, which is maximizing the 5% that was just discussed earlier, your employer will put £60 on top of that, and theoretically, out of the 100 that you are contributing, 80 is you, and 20 is from your pay package, or from the government, or tax relief, in other words, because you're not having to pay that 20% income tax on that amount. Now, of course, if you are a higher taxpayer, you get even more income tax relief. If you pay 40% tax on, you know, your salary, and that £100 now gets split £60 you, £40 from the government, and it, again, additional rate, you're getting the most tax relief out of everyone. So this is really, really important knowledge. If you get that money paid into your bank account, you have to, of course, pay that tax, and it is costing you more than had you left it or gone straight into your pension out of your pre-tax salary. Now, there are some rules and stipulations, aren't there, Lee, regarding, you know, getting this full match scheme from your company. For example, you know, it's 5 and 3. If I put in 5% of my salary, they'll put in 3. What if I say I want to do 4? What happens at that point?
Again, it depends how generous your employer is. So, as I say, there are statutory requirements there for employers, and it's 8%. Now, there's a slight caveat on that they can do it as what's called banded earnings, which makes a tiny bit of complication, but we'll put that to one side. The minimum contribution is at 8%. If you have an employer that's more generous, I quite commonly come across employers that will do a match scheme, and if you pay more money in, they potentially will pay more money in. But it really is on a scheme-by-scheme basis. There's nothing to stop you paying more money in, even if your employer doesn't, because you will still benefit from tax relief. So if you think about that, for every £8 as a basic rate taxpayer that you decide to contribute net, you're going to have a £10 effectively contribution made to your pension. So it'd be brilliant if your employer matched every single penny as well as the tax relief. But the reality is a lot of employers will, unfortunately, most employers will do just the minimum. But if you've got a very generous employer, and this is what I would urge you to do, look at your contracts of employment, because if you've got a scheme where it's an 8%, a 9%, a 10% matched scheme, then again, you would be bonkers not to take that on board and get that extra money from the employer, because it's free money going into your savings plan that you can use. And I think one thing that sometimes puts people off maybe paying more money into pensions is most people on average have 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 jobs over their lifetime. Once the money's in your scheme, in a defined contribution scheme or a workplace pension, it's your money. So when you leave your employer, you just take it and you take it with you, and you either transfer it into the next scheme or you leave it as a standalone pension. So it is ring-fenced and it is your money forever.
Okay. I think we've got pensions 101 out the way. We can see the benefits, some brilliant and incredible things you can do financially with pensions. Let's now talk about some of the key questions that I often get when it comes to pensions. The first one is the complication around, like you just mentioned, working multiple jobs and therefore having multiple pensions. They feel like they're all over the place. I'm actually not sure exactly where they are. Should I figure that out and bring them all together? Is there an easy way to do that? Should I leave them where they are and, you know, start a new pot every single time? What is the general, I suppose, advice to someone in this position, having worked multiple jobs and trying to figure out where they are, keep them as they are, or bring them together?
Right. Well, the very first thing is you need to definitely join your new employer scheme. What they in the main will not do is if you turn up and say, well, I've got this scheme with Royal London that my other employer was running, will you contribute to that? Most employers won't do it. So you have to join the scheme that employer has in place in the main for you to get the contributions we discussed earlier. Whether then you consolidate all those schemes together is not an easy question to answer, because it's not, from a convenience point of view, absolutely having it all in one place may be the better thing for you to do, to manage them. But you've got to be mindful over, there are different choices of funds you can choose from different schemes. You may be more limited in the new scheme than you were previously. There may be different charging structures. So you start to drift into an area of complication where it may be that you need to do a little bit more research, and you maybe need to maybe even take advice, because it isn't just a case of going, well, I'm moving here, let's just bring it all together. You need to really analyse the different schemes to work out if that's best for you.
Okay, I like that. It's a really good answer. And there are plenty of services online that do help you locate, for example, lost pensions. I know there's billions of pounds in lost pensions at the moment, which is absolutely frightening. So if you do know someone that's getting close to retirement, there are plenty of resources. Please do look into them. The last most common question that I get is around being self-employed, because we've obviously spoken a lot about, you know, being an employee and having those pension schemes. What's your recommendation if to people that are self-employed around paying into a pension? Are there any benefits of paying into a pension? And how do they even do it in the first place if it's not through a scheme?
So this is where, if you are self-employed, and I would call if you are a sole trader or even running your own limited company, it is massively important that you also take on board. You will get the, okay, you're not going to get a max contribution from the employer because you are your employer, but you'll certainly get tax relief. If you are a sole trader, you will make a contribution into a pension scheme and the pension provider will claim that tax relief, the basic rate of tax relief back for you. If you're a higher rate taxpayer, you need to apply to HMRC or through a tax return to get that. But it's exactly the same rules. If you run your own business or yourself or self-employed, you've got to start a pension. It is the most tax efficient way that you can build money over time. And I think if I could give the listeners one takeaway of all of these things, the tax relief is great, your employer matched contributions are great. My findings are people are not brave enough when it comes to how they invest their money. If you have a long period of time, I'm talking about 10 years plus to retirement, you need to take a really growth orientated approach. You need to have high equity. A global equity fund is perfect, but you need to invest in a way to maximize those returns, both from the tax man and your employer as well. So self-employed, exactly the same story. Pay in as much as you can, get the tax relief, and you'll have the same benefits at the end.
Lee, you beat me to it. I was going to ask you for that one piece of advice right at the end, and you've done it. You've beaten me to the question. You knew it was coming. Thank you so much for your time, and I'm hoping that everyone listening to this goes straight into looking into what their current pension situation is and how they can maximise the benefit. And go check you out at Lee the Pension Guy, correct?
Perfect. Lee the Pensions Guy. Any questions you have, that just fire them into me. I'm more than happy to help.
Wicked. Thank you, Lee. Well, there you go, people. That is everything you need to know about pensions, done in about 15 minutes. I do not think you can do it quicker in any other walk of life. If you do have questions, either hit Lee up or hit us on @ThatMoneyShow on Instagram. We will answer your pension questions. I'll do my best. I think I know enough about pensions. They're pretty cool products, in my opinion. I have one. I pay into one. So there we go. It is now time for our famous segment, Money Tip of the Week. And traditionally, I would have probably just told you right now to pay into a pension. But I actually want to go back to the Barclays story that I was telling you about a few seconds ago, which was about Barclays systems going down on Friday. And this, in this digital age of bank accounts, where you have numerous different bank accounts, then it's really important to make sure your money is safe and protected. Well, I want to make you very aware of a scheme called the Financial Service Compensation Scheme, FSCS. Now, you might have actually seen on a lot of your financial products or financial accounts, at the bottom it has written down FSCS protected. Now, this isn't just a fancy little signature. This is really important. And what it means is, if you are FSCS protected in your bank account, let's say Barclays, if, for example, due to fraud or due to, you know, the bank going into liquidation, not that Barclays ever should, but should that happen and you have £85,000 in your bank account or less, you will be paid the full amount back in compensation through this scheme. It's a bit like an insurance policy. It's up to £85,000. So £100,000, you might only get £85,000. It's up to, again, the company, the bank, to provide whether they're able to pay you more than that. But that is the minimum, the maximum currently that you will get paid back. You will be covered if you have up to £85,000. And this is just something to be aware of. Once you do start to get a lot of equity, a lot of finances in your life in your later ages, do you want to have £100,000 in one account? Obviously, that's a brilliant position to be. Or do you want to start putting 85 in one and start building into another? Just be aware that it's 85,000 is the current level of protection. This might go up in the near future, but just something to be aware of. And that is my tip of the week. Barclays, I'm not calling you out for any reason. I'm sure you're going to be around for a long time, but it's good to know. Anyway, stick around, guy, because straight after this, I'm going to be joined by Ricardo Mighty, CEO of Mighty Labs, to talk all things cryptocurrency.
FUBAR Radio.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Jill Jarrison, my Yes I Yes sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Malani and Zoe Grunewald.
What would you be advising the Labour leadership to do at this point?
My view is just apologise. I went to the theatre last night. I'm with my wife and family, and as I'm walking, a bloke says very loudly, John McDonnell, has he paid for his tickets? I went back to the bloke, said, yeah, I did pay for my tickets, and I always do. What that whole ticketing thing and all the free gifts thing doesn't just damage those individuals, it damages us all, because they all think, oh, they're all the same, and we're not.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the crazy truth. And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle. I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Making personal finance simpler with Gabriel Nussbaum. This is That Money Show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show, live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy. And I am joined now by Ricardo Mighty. He is the CEO of Mighty Labs, as you can tell, it's in the name. He is a software developer turned crypto investor who has been actively investing in crypto for the last 8 years. Oh, I probably should have started 8 years ago. And he's going to help us walk us through this crazy world of cryptocurrency that seems to be a very hot topic at the moment. Anyway, Ricardo, welcome to That Money Show. How are you doing today?
Hey, Gabriel, I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and I'm very excited to dive into the world of crypto because I am that money guy. So I traditionally deal with, well, more traditional investment opportunities, let's say, stocks and shares. That's my world. That's my bread and butter. I don't know a lot about cryptocurrencies. So, I mean, I might need your help on this. Do you want to walk me through right from the start? What are cryptocurrencies to those that literally hear the word and think, you know, it's a fad, it's a trend?
All right, so I'll start from the very beginning. So the whole idea of cryptocurrency was started in 2009, where this guy, he's anonymous, Satoshi Nakamoto, decided he wanted to challenge how banks control money and how governments control money. And he basically went away and said, I'm going to build this thing that doesn't depend on a centralized system. It doesn't depend on a government. It doesn't depend on a country. It's going to be this thing that is managed by a decentralized network, which is, yeah, TLDR is just between me and you. So he went away, he built a white paper, and then he built the prototype for Bitcoin, launched it. No one cared about it for quite a while. People were seemingly uninterested. Fast forward, I think it was up until about 2014, we had another big cryptocurrency come out, which is Ethereum. And Ethereum really set the pace and really like highlighted to everyone that crypto is a big thing and it's here to stay. So Bitcoin came around. People were very skeptical. There's loads of stories back in the day. People were buying, you know, pizzas for 100 Bitcoin, which in today's world is like hundreds of millions of dollars. But back then it was, I have this internet money and I'm going to transfer it to you. And you just have to believe me that it's going to be worth something in the future. And now Bitcoin as a token is worth over $100,000, something like £75,000, which is massively big news. But I think the biggest shift was people initially thought it was just this fad that, you know, people on the internet were using, to now governments, i.e., you know, you must have heard Donald Trump has quite a large crypto offering that he wants to offer for the US citizens, and various countries around the world are starting to pick up Bitcoin and put it on their balance sheets and decide this is actually a real big thing that we're actually going to invest in. So it went all the way from speculation to where it is now, which is now becoming a more institutionalized and real form of wealth.
That is probably the best summary I have ever heard of cryptocurrency. So thank you. Thank you very much for that. That was really interesting to hear. And like you said, we're now looking, it's 2025. Bitcoin crossed over that $100,000 mark, which was kind of felt like the next ceiling for it to break. But every so often, every few years, it seems like it's breaking through yet another ceiling. It becomes the hot topic. Everyone's interested in it again. Then it goes quiet and it simmers in the background again. And then it comes again. So we're in that kind of period right now where it's the absolute rage of the town. Like you mentioned, thanks to Donald Trump and all the things that he's discussing, probably worth mentioning Elon Musk in the same breath right now, because he is, you know, one of the biggest crypto advocates out there, full stop. If anyone's heard of Doge, apparently it's not just a meme coin anymore. It's now officially a governmental, you know, organization inside of the White House soon. So there's a lot going on in the world of crypto. And on top of that, you know, the stories you're talking about from decades ago, people throwing hundreds of million pounds worth of crypto wallets into the bin and not being able to find them. People buying pizzas for millions of pounds worth of crypto today. It is a crazy world, whether we like it or not, just because of, I suppose, its monumental rise over the past decade in valuation. So let's talk about your story then. 8 years, a crypto investor. How did you get into it, and how have you been able to grow such a wealth of knowledge around the topic?
Okay, so for me, so as I said, as you mentioned, I'm a software guy. So I remember Ethereum was released, and the whole point of the blockchain and crypto is that it's this digital thing that if you're tech savvy, you can go in and you can play with and you can utilize. And so I remember Ethereum as a whole had the initial coin offering, which is similar to our IPO, except you get a lot of people that aren't institutional investors buying your token. They had an ICO, they released their token, and then they started to do a lot of events. And a lot of the events were in London. And me being a developer that was in London at the time, I decided to go to one of the big ETH Global events, which was actually just like 20 guys in a lecture theater in Imperial. And I was like, brilliant. This was like 10 minutes from where I lived at the time. I went down there. I met a bunch of guys who were, I'm going to say, nerdy guys that didn't really care about anything in terms of currency. They just cared about the technology. They're just like, hey, man, if I can send, you know, $20 to my friend in America for like very cheap, that's amazing. And that was the premise for them. And so I went to this event and I was like, I'm going to try it out. You could build these things called decentralized apps on top of the blockchain. So you could build things like games. You could build things like, I'm going to build this website that allows me to send some tokens from me to you. And it was, it was cool. And I remember doing it and thinking, this is cool as technology. I'm just going to leave this alone. This was around August. And then in December that year, I just remember seeing in the news, Ethereum is gone up in value drastically, and they give you some test tokens when you're testing it out. So I had these test tokens, and I remember they must have gave me something like £20 worth. When I checked again in December, when I saw the news, it was like £200. I was like, hey, I'm missing something here. And since then, to be honest, I've just jumped straight in. I've just been, I've worked for crypto companies across the UK and across the world. And I've just decided to take it upon myself to learn as much as I can about crypto, about investing, about financial markets, and about not so much trading, because I just feel like it's impossible to be a day trader or, mm-hmm. or trade in and out of a market. So, yeah. So for me, it's like long-term investment, and yeah, it's worked out pretty well for me. And now I just want to share the knowledge. So hence why I'm out here talking to everyone.
I love that. And I want to stress something you just mentioned, because a lot of people hear this crypto, you know, the boom, the bubbles, the, all this kind of stuff, the range of prices, the incredible stories, and they want to start trading it, day trading it, like you just mentioned. And I just want to kind of stress that, that I'm currently talking to someone that is a software developer, has been in it for 8 years, and they themselves are sharing that they don't feel like they have the knowledge or, you know, the expertise to trade this stuff on a, you know, on a very short term basis. And I'm not going to give any advice off the back of that. I'm just going to say, take that information and understand kind of where you guys are up to listening to this show. It's impossible to mention crypto without mentioning volatility. It is volatile. It of course is. You see swings. I mean, even over, I think, the past few days, you've had a negative swing of like 6-7%. That's quite large. I know you can see that in normal traditional markets as well, but there've been even bigger swings. So let's talk about safety of cryptocurrency, and about people that are trying to get into it at the moment. How can people, you know, enter the world of cryptocurrency, but make sure that they're knowledgeable enough to understand the risks that come with it?
Yeah, I think I just really have to stress the point you made. So Bitcoin's biggest drop was 80% in 1 year. If a regular company dropped 80% in 1 year, everyone would be flying the flags. The company's gone. Leave it alone. And even yesterday, between yesterday and today, Bitcoin dropped from like $105,000 to 91. It's super volatile. So I just think if you're going to get into crypto, you just can't think short term. If you're trying to, I don't know, like pay your bills next month and you think I'm going to invest in crypto this month and then I'm going to take the gains out and do something with, you just can't think like that, because 99.9% of the time, the market doesn't work the way you want it to work. It works how it's going to work. So essentially, the longer you have your investment in crypto, most likely the better it will do. And if you look at, you know, Bitcoin 5 years ago was something like 20K. I think we topped out about 20K in 2020. That's crazy. 20K in US dollars. Now it's like five times that amount. But you couldn't, 5 years ago, you couldn't say in a month, I'm going to take it out and it's going to be five times the amount. It just wouldn't work. So yeah, you just have to have a long-term vision. Yeah. I'd say make sure you stick to cryptocurrency exchanges that are in the best place they can be. So for instance, I mean, yeah, I don't want to promote any specific cryptocurrency exchange. But for instance, Coinbase, which has been around for quite a while, has never been hacked. And they're a good exchange, ultimately. Similarly with exchanges like Binance. Now, if you're going to an exchange where, you know, you refer to by a friend and they literally came around 2 months ago, you're just putting yourself in a situation where that exchange could be hacked. Your money could be lost. These things are, I know you just mentioned FCS.
FSCS protection.
FSCS. crypto doesn't have that because crypto is not labeled as like a proper asset yet. It's in the pipeworks and it will be. But until then, if your crypto goes and you have it on any of these centralized platforms, that's it. It's gone. They can't do anything for you. Some of them offer you protection of your funds up to £85,000, which is great. But yeah, if you want to long term this thing, you might eventually get over that amount.
Okay.
So yeah, I just say be careful of where you go and you buy your exchange. Make sure it's a really big, we call them tier one exchanges. And then as soon as you buy your exchange on a tier one exchange, you transfer it to what we call a cold wallet. So a cold wallet is something like Ledger or Trezor, and you can go and Google them. Never buy it secondhand because there's some scammy hacks that people can do with them. Buy one from the shop, put it on your Ledger. It splits up your tokens safety into like 12 or 24 words. You can split those words up, give one to your mom, give one to your dad, give one to your cousin, whatever, and then keep the rest for yourself, or just keep them in somewhere very secure. And then you are the only one that can access that. And this thing will live on a little ledger that will keep it forever. And yeah, the value goes up. It goes up. Whenever you're ready to sell it, you can bring it back to an exchange and sell it. So yeah, I just say stay away from a lot of new cryptocurrency exchanges and just don't... There's a lot of people online that talk about crypto. Just don't follow everyone that you see online, because if they do crypto full time, especially in times where the market's not so good, you're the customer. Like, what your attention is their custom. And I just think if they're doing it for that cause, it just kind of feels like they're doing it because they want something from you, as opposed to, you know, people that are just honestly trying to give information out.
I think you've shared some brilliant advice there. Stay safe. I like that at the end as well. That is really useful stuff. I appreciate your time today. And yeah, listen, guys, if you are going to get into a lot of crypto, I think there's a poignant point about educating yourself on the safety of it first, on understanding the volatility of it first before diving in. Don't get into any fad, any trend, anything like that. Make sure you always do your own research and understand that these things are volatile. You go up and down, you know, all the classic exclaimers. But the key one is to do your research. Anyway, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you for giving me the world of cryptocurrency. And like I said, the best ever 2-minute explanation I've ever had on what is cryptocurrency in my entire life. So thank you for doing that.
Love it. Thanks for having me, Gabriel.
Cheers. Well, there you go. That's everything you need to know about cryptocurrency. Well, not everything you need to know about cryptocurrency, but quite a lot that you need to know about cryptocurrency, said in a really nice way. Like I said, cryptocurrency isn't my world in particular. I do understand a little bit, but that's why you bring in experts. And you should always be aware that, you know, this is all on your own risk. It can go up, it can go down. People can say what they want, but ultimately, this is your decision, your money. So be safe out there, guys. Now, it is time for your questions. Every week, you guys DM us on Instagram. We have the handle at That Money Show. And I answer your questions. So if you're watching live right now, you can ask your questions away there and I'll try and get to them. But let's start off with Jody, who DM'd us and asked, am I entitled to a refund if a subscription I have, I think it's a gym membership, because she said a gym membership, for example, so I assume it was a gym membership, goes up without my knowledge. So Jody, the simple answer is yes. If they have increased the price without telling you they are going to increase the price, you don't have to sign off on anything. They need to make sure that you agree to any price rise. But I would be surprised if they hadn't had something included in your contract that says, you know, your gym price is subject to rise or renewal at this point in time, and it will be going up by X percent. Especially with phone contracts, for example, they need to be very clear nowadays with the amount that your phone contract is going to rise every single year, if they are going to raise it due to inflation. So the answer is, if they have done it without your knowledge and there was no contractual written anything about it, then yes, you are entitled to a refund. But I would check all of the details provided, because it's very likely that they have. Next question, whilst you guys are typing to me live on the stream. But it is, why are we required to have car insurance in the UK, but other types of insurance are optional? I'll make it really simple for you. If you're driving a car and you get hit by someone else and they are not insured, there is no one to kind of pay for that recovery. So you're going to pay for that recovery out of your own pocket, right? It just means that everyone is covered should any scenario of anyone getting hit and anyone being at fault. Whereas, for example, let's say you insure, you know, an item. Let's say you have contents insurance in your house. Ultimately, there's no other kind of party that needs to kind of cover or pay out that insurance, because it's not like two people involved in a car crash are crashing into each other. Do you see what I mean? There's two parties at that point. If you get robbed and your stuff gets stolen, you go to your insurer, that's just a one-party transaction. That's why it's optional. And that's why it's up to you whether or not you pay for that. It's not like they're going to go to the robber or the guy that burgled your house and say, are you insured? Because then we can take it out of your insurance. You see the logic there. That's simply why car insurance is mandatory in this country and you cannot drive without it. Last question is from Tori, who said, what is the stamp duty holiday and why is it coming to an end? This is a very relevant question, Tori, and it is occurring at the end of March. So for those of you that don't know, stamp duty is basically tax when you buy a property. So when you go and buy a house, you actually have to pay additional amount tax to the government. Now, if you're a first-time buyer, there are some kind of like policies that make it a little bit more, well, beneficial to you. But generally there, well, what is happening at the end of March is that there was a small holiday on how much stamp duty you had to pay and kind of the thresholds of when it started having to be paid. And these are returning to what they were before this holiday. So what is happening is, for example, current stamp duty was between 425 and 625. So for this is for first time buyers, between if you paid less than 425 on a property, that's 425,000. You paid 0% stamp duty. Between 425 and 625, you paid a reduced stamp stamp duty. And then if you had bought a property over 625,000, you did not get any reduced stamp duty. You paid the standard amount. These are all being reduced back down by 125,000 at the end of March, the 1st of April. So from then on, now, if you're going to buy a property, if you're a first-time buyer in this scenario, it starts at 300,000. So if your property is now under 300,000, you don't pay stamp duty. It used to be under 425,000. If your property is under 500,000, you still get a first-time buyer's benefit. It used to be under 625,000. So in some scenarios, for example, if your property is 425,000, your stamp duty is going up from zero up to, I think, 6,250. And if you're buying a property at 625,000, your property is going up, or your stamp duty is going up by over £11,000. In other words, if you're currently in the process of pushing through a completion of a property, get it done before the end of March. You will save yourself some money. And this isn't just for first-time buyers, by the way. This is for everyone. Anyway, that brings us to the end of today's show. So I would like to say thank you to Lee. I would like to say thank you to Ricardo for their time on the show. Like I said, we have officially made you better with money. I've been that money guy. This has been That Money Show. And we'll see you next week.